Vice Chancellor, dear colleagues and friends, dear students, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, thank you very much for your very kind and generous introduction. And thank you all for coming this evening to my professorial lecture on Hannah Arendt. I feel honored and privileged by this opportunity. And I hope that this lecture will allow at least a glimpse into one of the various research topics currently pursued at the History Department and at the Center for German Jewish Studies. The contribution of such topics to teaching and to research culture at Sussex University is, I would hope, manifold, broad, interdisciplinary, and important in a variety of ways, especially when discussing the link between historical phenomena and contemporary reality. Topics such as the one I chose for my professorial lecture, for example, are not distant, historical, irrelevant topics, but for example, the trial against Demjanjuk in Berlin shows how relevant these topics still are. By exploring topics such as antisemitism and xenophobia, migration, genocide, human rights, the role of historical memory, the identity of religious and ethnic groups in a globalized and secular world, interreligious dialogue, nationalism, peace strategies in the Middle East, this area of research provides rich opportunities for cooperation within the department and across disciplines, as well as outreach to the wider public. I would therefore like to begin my lecture by emphasizing how much I'm looking forward to expand existing or initiate new cooperation within the university with colleagues across the university, and also by expressing my gratitude for the support and for the collegiality I've enjoyed since I came to Sussex now 3 years ago. Let me start with an anecdote that can be found in a volume of an autobiographical essay published by German historian Joachim Fest in 2004. It tells how historian Gordon Craig, during a train ride in Germany, was welcomed by the following announcement. "I warmly welcome you on board of the ICE train 573 Hannah Arendt. Whoever Hannah Arendt was, I wish you a good journey on your travels from Stuttgart to Hamburg." A short while later, the voice was heard again saying, "Hannah Arendt was, as I have just learned, a successful Jewish writer." After another while, the voice announced that Hannah Arendt had been a political scientist, and this was finally followed by another statement saying, "I've just heard the real story, according to one of our passengers. Hannah Arendt was a philosopher who emigrated from Germany in 1933. May I please ask all fellow passengers to refrain from any further corrections?" I think this short episode provides an adequate impression of the many dimensions of Hannah Arendt's work and personality. She was indeed a successful writer, a thinker whose attention was devoted to political theory, and at the same time, indissolubly linked to philosophy and history. A Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany, an emigre scholar in the United States, whose share in the experience of German and European Jewry in the 20th century profoundly shaped the way she perceived modern history and the contemporary world. Probably no 20th century intellectual has, at the present time, a wider public echo than Hannah Arendt, with countless books and articles devoted to her every year, with equally numerous Hannah Arendt prizes and lectures, including, and I'm happy to announce that for the next year, an annual Hannah Arendt lecture on modern Jewish thought at the Center for German Jewish Studies here at Sussex, which will be inaugurated by a speech given by Sheila Ben Habib on Hannah Arendt and human rights in March. But what might seem like some sort of Hannah Arendt cult is part of a much wider and much more critical, often polemical discourse. Arendt was and remains an extremely controversial figure. And alongside the great admiration bestowed upon her, she has often been attacked both during her life and posthumously, particularly for her statements on Jewish affairs. Even though her present fame as a philosopher and political theorist goes, of course, well beyond Jewish interests, wider philosophy is largely unintelligible without her biographical roots and without her Jewish concerns. Whilst, as we will see, her attitude to the basic questions of Jewish history and Jewish and Zionist politics has been formed by her much more universal theoretical principles. German historian Dan Diener for example, claims that a close reading of Hannah Arendt's works reveals, quote, that her perspective, her epistemic vantage point in looking at the 20th century, was deeply affected by her Jewish awareness and her personal and political involvement in the fate of the Jews. It was the Jewish experience that imposed on her the relevant questions for her future thought and writing, namely the question of emancipation and assimilation, the question of human rights and minority experience, the crisis of the nation state, antisemitism and imperialism is originating in totalitarianism, the archipelago of the camps, and last but not least, the destruction of the Jews. Here she depicts herself as a person who believes in Jewish nationhood. Indeed, in all her writings on Jews and Jewish questions, Hannah Arendt does not hesitate to impose on the Jews the concept of a people, while lamenting the lack of a collective awareness by Jews of power, politics, and political action. The question concerning Hannah Arendt's Jewishness and Jewish identity in regard to her interpretation of the Holocaust that I would like to address tonight is a highly controversial, a highly contested one. But what is it about Arendt's writings that have rendered them so divisive and emotionally charged? To anticipate my answer to this question, it could be said that it is, on her part, her inclination to provoke and to hold seemingly contradictory positions. In her book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, she incisively analyzed the rise of modern political antisemitism, yet seemed to hold the Jews partly responsible for it. She was ideologically identified with the Zionist movement, and at the same time, one of its most severe critics. And she was one of the earliest and most concerned analysts of the Holocaust, yet it was precisely her book on the trial against Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem in 1961 that invoked a continuing, impassioned controversy which made her, for many, appear more an enemy than a friend of the Jewish people. A recent article by British historian Bernard Wasserstein, entitled Blame the Victim, published on 9 October 2009 in the Times Literary Supplement, depicts Arendt as a self-centered person, quote, whose attitude towards the Jews in general was far from affectionate. Somebody who tended to denigrate East European Jews as culturally inferior, and somebody who saw, quote, the German Jews as the center of Jewry, the stateless exiled refugees as the center of German Jewry, and herself as the queen bee among those intellectual emigres. An arrogant thinker, he says, who castigated almost every contemporary Jewish group, including religious and secular Zionists of all colors and anti-Zionists. Wasserstein stopped short of calling Arendt a Jewish anti-Semite, which others have done much more readily in response to her Eichmann book, and tries to show that much of Arendt's views on Jewish history and the Holocaust are not informed by Jewish historiography, which he rejected as apologetic, but by non-Jewish, often unfavorable, sometimes anti-Semitic literature. And he comes to the conclusion that in refusing to become an apologist for her own people, she collapsed into the other extreme, embracing, quote, a perverse worldview contaminated by overexposure to the discourse of collective contempt and stigmatization that formed the object of her study. These reflections demonstrate, I think, that polemical views continue to dominate the perception of Hannah Arendt, even almost 35 years after her death, and that a distant echo of the verdict quoted in my lecture title, that Arendt lacked love for the Jewish people, is still around. And whilst I don't feel in the position to answer the question whether or not this verdict is in fact true, what I would like to do tonight is to revisit the controversy, contextualize it, point to some links to current debates on Holocaust historiography and memory, and hopefully indicate the complexity of Arendt's Jewish self-understanding that, I would like to argue, resists simplistic conclusions. The conflict between Hannah Arendt and a number of her friends among German Jewish emigre intellectuals in Israel and the United States has started long before the Eichmann trial. Since the end of World War II, at the latest, she had shocked them by publicly dissociating herself from political Zionism. She had adopted a Zionist perspective under the impression of Nazi policy and had been active in promoting youth immigration to Palestine while she was living in France as a refugee in the 1930s. What had attracted her to Zionism was the willingness of the Zionists to take political responsibility for their actions. During the early years of the war, Arendt had enthusiastically embraced the idea of a Jewish army, not only to defend Palestine, but to fight Hitler everywhere, also in Europe, and thereby to restore Jewish dignity and honor. But her Jewish nationalism remained strongly reluctant. And interestingly, she never saw any connection at all between the creation of such an army and Jewish political sovereignty. After her emigration to the United States, she became a radical critic of Zionism and fiercely rejected the idea that Jewish freedom from persecution depended on the creation of a Jewish state. Most prominently in her article, Zionism Reconsidered, a polemical essay she published in 1944 in a German Jewish emigre journal. And although she praised Zionism for overcoming, quote, the mentality of enslaved peoples, the belief that it doesn't pay to fight back, that one must dodge and escape in order to survive, she accused the Zionist movement of having embraced a politics of the wrong kind. It was disturbing, she argued, that the Zionists would entrust the future of the Zionist enterprise to a model of chauvinistic nationalism and imperial power, and this at the very moment when imperialism had revealed its horrifyingly brutal potential. As Jews had been the victims of the nation-state system in Europe, it was incumbent on them to reject the political arrangement they knew to be unjust and find a morally more adequate alternative. The real relevance of her essays on Zionism from the 1940s lies, I think, in the conviction that the relationship with the Arab population in Palestine and the Arab nations in the Near East constituted, quote, the only real political and moral issue of Zionist politics. She shared this view with a minority of German Jewish intellectuals, including Gershom Scholem, who rejected the creation of a Jewish majority state in Palestine and envisaged alternative social and political orders that would satisfy both Jewish national aspirations and Arab needs. Aiming at promoting a peaceful coexistence between Jews and Arabs in Palestine in a binational, federal, or confederative state, they harbored the dream of a form of Jewish nationalism that was not based on the idea of national power, but attempted to counter the experience of chauvinism, war, and genocide in Europe with a more moral concept of nationalism. This group's and Hannah Arendt's views point to the fundamental predicament Zionism faced during the 1940s, namely how to preserve the moral character of Jewish nationalism in a situation in which the survival of millions of Jews in Europe was at stake, whilst a tragic conflict between Jewish immigrants and the Arab population was unfolding in Palestine. Arendt's essays on Zionism after the war are dominated by powerful statements of the dangers which would threaten a potential Jewish state if it came into being without the consent of Palestine's Arab population. The inalterable fact of the Near East, she said, was that the Arabs were the Jews' neighbors. The Jews had the choice of either working out an agreement with the Arabs or seeking the protection of one of the great imperial powers. By choosing the latter, the concept of a Jewish state would become farcical insofar as that state would be a bastion of imperial interests in an area striving to liberate itself from colonialism. On the other hand, Arendt recognized that Arab policies were equally blind in not recognizing the needs and concrete achievements of Zionists in Palestine. She believed genuinely that cooperation between Jews and Arabs in the Middle East could be the basis for true sovereignty and independence. But the only way for this to occur was if both sides gave up the national perspectives and claims. When the War of Independence broke out in 1948, Arendt feared that the hopes of the Jewish survivors from the Holocaust would be extinguished in another catastrophe that might result into the tragedy of a self-dissolution of the Jewish people. But even if the Jews were to win the war, she predicted, Zionism's unique possibilities in Palestine would be destroyed. A long period of military insecurity would make military self-defense the eternal priority of the Jewish state. The Jewish state, she asserted, would not solve the Jewish problem, its tragic result being that anti-Semitism would transform into anti-Zionism, and that the Jewish people, the pariah people, she says, would have created nothing else than a pariah state that would be constantly threatened by and involved in bloody conflicts. And in 1951, in The Origins of Totalitarianism, she sharply noted, quote, "After the war, it turned out that the Jewish question, which was considered the only insoluble one, was indeed solved, namely by means of a colonized and then conquered territory. But this solved neither the problem of the minorities nor the stateless. On the contrary, like virtually all other events of our century, the solution of the Jewish question merely produced a new category of refugees, the Arabs, thereby increasing the number of the stateless and rightless by another 700,000 to 800,000 people." Of course, an appropriation of Arendt's writings on Zionism today, despite her many important insights, is extremely difficult. Her reflections were the product of a time and context quite different from our own, and neither a simplistic Zionist condemnation nor an undifferentiated anti-Zionist harnessing would do justice to her intentions. Some have rightly criticized that Arendt refused to view the Zionist movement in other than highly chauvinistic and non-humanitarian terms, instead of acknowledging that there existed a number of competing tendencies in Zionism, and that when her utopian vision became impossible to maintain, she appeared to simply turn her back in scorn. Others have asked, on the other hand, whether some of the thoughts that emerge from behind Arendt's critique of nationalism ought not to be reconsidered under quite different historical conditions in the present, for example, in this idea of a binational state. These are, of course, very difficult and controversial questions that I cannot discuss in more detail. The least one can argue, however, is that Arendt's insistence on the political centrality and relevance of the moral aspect of the relationship to the Palestinian people belongs to a legacy that cannot be easily ignored. On the other hand, it has to be emphasized that Arendt was not indifferent towards the fate of the State of Israel. On different occasions, especially when wars were raging in the Middle East, she expressed genuine concern over the fate of Israel, admitting that she could not imagine a greater catastrophe for her personally than its destruction. This is important to emphasize in view of the fact that some of Israel's bitterest critics, from within and outside, have often used her, particularly her book on the Eichmann trial, as supportive evidence in radically delegitimizing Israel and the Zionist idea. Now, Arendt's critique of Zionism and what she perceived as dominating Zionist historical narrative eventually erupted on the occasion of the trial against Adolf Eichmann. And just a quick reminder about the events. In May 1960, Adolf Eichmann, who had managed the deportation of Jews from all over Europe to the Nazi death camps during 1942 to 1944, was abducted from Buenos Aires, where he had found refuge after World War II, and taken to Israel. His capture was announced to the world on 26 May 1960, and he stood trial in Jerusalem between April and December 1961. He was found guilty and sentenced to death. Following an unsuccessful appeal to Israel's Supreme Court, he was executed on 31st May 1962. Eichmann's capture, trial, and execution were to change forever perceptions of the Nazi persecution and mass murder of European Jewry. Eichmann was the first Nazi official to be tried primarily for crimes against the Jewish people. The evidence and testimony amassed by the prosecution ensured that Nazi anti-Jewish policy and the experience of those it had affected were expressed with unprecedented force and clarity. At the same time, it was an event that triggered the first major and probably most passionate controversy among Jewish intellectuals in Israel and the United States about an appropriate historical representation and memory of the Holocaust and its victims. And this was mainly a result of the trial report Hannah Arendt sent from Jerusalem to be published in The New Yorker and later as her famous book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil in 1963. Her provocative, polarizing interpretation of the event and what to many appeared as a sarcastic, even malicious tone unleashed an extreme reaction. She was accused of displaying a grave lack of knowledge of Jewish culture and history, an irresponsible handling of the facts, and above all, in the famous correspondence with Gershom Scholem of lacking compassion and love for the Jewish people. There are at least three narratives in Eichmann in Jerusalem, each of which could have had bitter debates as a result. First is Arendt's sarcastic reporting of the behavior of Chief Prosecutor Gideon Hausner during the proceedings. Second is the account of the role of the Jewish councils, the special committees appointed by the Nazis in 1939 in the administration of the Jewish populations in Eastern Europe, and of their role in cooperating with the Nazis in carrying out the so-called final solution. And third is Arendt's attempt to come to grips with the behavior of so-called ordinary German citizens during the Nazi regime and the Holocaust. Eichmann, for her, becomes a paradigm case for analyzing how people who were not particularly evil or fanatical could take a leading role in genocidal politics. And it is the coming together of these narratives with Arendt's philosophical thesis concerning the banality of evil that outraged her readers. I should devote some attention to this aspect, since it was this concept of the banality of evil that was often misinterpreted, but that at the same time reflects the problematic nature of her interpretation of the Holocaust and points to the challenging questions faced by present Holocaust representation as well. It has to be emphasized that for Arendt, Eichmann's guilt in the murder of European Jews and other people is beyond dispute. He willingly and efficiently transported millions to the laboratories of death, and he must be hanged for his deeds, she says. However, she looked at this man in the glass cage, and what she saw was a minor figure whose inability to speak reflected, from her point of view, an inability to think, let alone to develop a moral point of view. She refused to depict him as the latest demonic embodiment of a long tradition of hatred against the Jews. He was not an evil man, no fanatic or even a sadist who enjoyed sending people to the gas chambers. He was an empty-headed careerist who jumped on the Nazis' bandwagon and slid into the conduct of genocide because he was an opportunist and a loyal, obedient civil servant, thus personifying what she calls the banality of evil. Despite all the efforts, she says, of the persecution, everybody would see that this man was not a monster, but it was difficult indeed not to suspect that he was a clown. In the final pages of The Origins of Totalitarianism, Hannah Arendt had written that with the Nazi extermination camps, quote, some radical evil previously unknown to us had occurred. In Eichmann in Jerusalem, she gave up this term, without, however, abandoning the view that what had happened confronted humankind with unprecedented crime. The terms banality of evil and thoughtlessness, which she used to describe Eichmann, were bound to be misunderstood in a polemical context, but it is quite obvious that she did not mean to trivialize the Holocaust. The point she tried to make was just that unremarkable people are capable of extreme evil. Whether or not one agrees with her assessment of Eichmann's psychology, what seems clear is that the phrase banality of evil was meant to refer to a specific quality of mind and character of the perpetrator himself, and neither to the systematic mass murder nor to the principles behind it. The banality of evil describes the ethical failure of perpetrators to think, to grasp the meaning of their actions. What is most frightening, Richard Bernstein says in Arendt's defense, quote, is that this monstrous deed, this deliberate attempt to destroy and transform the human condition, does not require monstrous or evil motives. There are, of course, a variety of problems with Arendt's concept that are controversial in Holocaust historiography until this very day. One of them concerns the historical accuracy of her description. Israeli historian Yaakov Lotzevik, in his book Hitler's Bureaucrats, the Nazi Security Police and the Banality of Evil, comes to the conclusion that the majority of the Nazi bureaucrats, including Eichmann, were indeed driven by a fanatic ideological belief system and hatred for the Jews. And this is corroborated by David Cesarani's book, Eichmann, His Life and Crimes, published in 2004, which tries to prove how, far from being merely an industrious underling, dispassionately implementing orders, Eichmann embraced the Nazi ideology and became a convinced and fervent believer in the idea that the Jews were Germany's arch enemy. He was thus fully responsible for what he chose to be, namely, first an expert on forced Jewish immigration, then the organizer of brutal expulsions in Poland between 1939 and 1941, later the agent of the mass deportations in 1941, and ultimately the orchestrator of the Final Solution. Interestingly enough, however, despite his rejection of Hannah Arendt's views, Cesarani concedes that no special personal monstrosity is needed to commit extraordinary crimes. All that is required are the right conditions and ordinary human nature. In view of the fact that ethnic cleansing has returned as an instrument of policy in many parts of the world, Cesarani puts it this way, quote, Eichmann appears more and more like a man of our time, every man as genocidaire. Another problematic aspect of Arendt's interpretation is that by dissociating the banal murderer Eichmann from anti-Semitic ideology, she extracts him from the specific context of the Jewish experience, placing the story of the Holocaust within the more universalizing frame of human evil in its modern variant, genocide. Eichmann merely exemplified how anyone would behave under totalitarianism. So the charges should have been framed universally as genocide and crimes against humanity. In fact, she thought that the Jerusalem court failed to understand the uniqueness of this crime. Had it understood that, quote, there were distinctions between discrimination, expulsion, and genocide, it would immediately have become clear that the supreme crime it was confronted with, the physical extermination of the Jewish people, was a crime against humanity, perpetrated upon the body of the Jewish people, and that only the choice of the victims, not the nature of the crime, could be derived from the long history of Jew hatred and anti-Semitism. Insofar as the victims were Jews, it was right and proper that a Jewish court should sit in judgment. But insofar as the crime was a crime against humanity, it needed an international tribunal to do justice to it. Bringing Eichmann to trial was an occasion for thinking the universal meaning of genocide in the modern age, not for dealing with the specific victims. Quite understandably, most Jewish intellectuals at that time read her book as saying that Auschwitz could have happened everywhere, to anyone, as if Jews had no special connection with it. All of this outraged them, for it seemed to make their particular suffering a matter of indifference. The real problem of Arendt's construct of the banality of evil seems indeed to be that it does not coincide with the experiences of the Nazi victims and survivors. For them, evil was not the mere result of an administratively structured accumulation of banalities, but rather a psychologically and physically experienced monstrosity. Both perspectives represent different conceptions of history and gave rise to opposing perspectives in the representation of the Nazi genocide. In some ways, the banality of evil thesis has become the cornerstone of the so-called functionalist interpretation of the Holocaust. It emphasizes the role of modern bureaucracy in producing a qualitatively new, impersonal form of mass death, a machinery of destruction devoid of any ideological conviction and personal responsibility. The image of Eichmann as a social engineer, a mere technician of deportation for extermination, symbolizes this approach. And as research during the last decades has shown, there's a lot one can learn about the Holocaust and about genocide in general by focusing on those bureaucratic dimensions of the killing process. What this approach fails to come to grips with, however, is the specificity of the particular genocide, that is, the fact that it explicitly and systematically targeted the European Jews. It tends to overlook the absolute centrality of anti-Semitism to the Nazi worldview. The distinctive feature of Auschwitz, I would like to argue, was not just its bureaucratic character. Instead, it was the fact that modern bureaucratic methods were placed in the service of a totalizing and fanatic racist ideology. Hannah Arendt would, of course, have vigorously contradicted. Since she had come to Jerusalem full of reservations with regard to Israel, its government, its Arab policy, she was guided by the suspicion that with the Eichmann trial, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion and the Chief Prosecutor Gideon Hausner sought to impose and codify for the Israeli nation a narrative of an eternal Jewish history of anti-Semitism, suffering, and persecution culminating in the Holocaust. A narrative which he tried to unmask as a nationalistic interpretation of Jewish history in the service of legitimizing the state of Israel and the politics of power. Such a narrative seemed to require the image of Adolf Eichmann as a monstrous criminal driven by a fanatical anti-Semitic ideology. Arendt was quite rightly convinced that this could be a highly distorted view of Jewish history. However, her narrative is no less polemical and deviates no less from historical reality. Her version made the Holocaust simply one instance of a larger class of rational mass murder in modernity, rather than a unique evil event perpetrated by people who put themselves in service of fanatic ideology. What is strangely absent in Arendt's report are the testimonies of the victims, the very element that endowed the Eichmann trial with its historical value and significance. She completely silenced the voice of the victims and survivors, leaving no room for a specific Jewish viewpoint on the Holocaust. Arendt explicitly argues that the trial should have taken place without the survivors' accounts. Whatever could be learned from them was irrelevant for a clarification of the legal and philosophical nature of the crime that Eichmann had committed. In Arendt's view, the Holocaust was not the story of what had happened to the Jews. Rather, it was what the Germans had done, their motives, and the true account of the facts. She turns the story of the Jewish Holocaust into a kind of objective model of a universal problem, the crimes against humanity made possible by modern totalitarian regimes. The narrative of Jewish suffering was something secondary, from her point of view, a sentimental detail that could cloud the clarity of historical judgment. In contrast to this, for most of the other Jewish observers, the dominant riveting experience in the trial was, on the contrary, the testimony of the survivors that transformed the Holocaust for the first time in public into a human tale, accessible and connected with real lives. The difference between the public experience and Arendt's views reflect two very different schools in research on the Holocaust. Is the focus on the perpetrator's deeds or on what the victim suffered? If the actions of the perpetrators are foregrounded, then it is but a short leap to examining the question of evil more generally, in philosophical and universal terms. If the spotlight is on the suffering of the Jews as real flesh and blood human beings, then the Holocaust is a unique event, Jewish in its very essence. Thus, the differing approach to testimony and witnesses points to fundamental differences in perspective. Last year, in fact, in this room, historian Saul Friedlander, during a conference organized by the History Department, presented his contrasting view of what he called an integrative history of the Holocaust. According to his interpretation in his book, Nazi Germany and the Jews, the voice of the victims is an essential part of this story. Not the only one, but one without which the general story of the Holocaust cannot be written. It was, however, as already indicated, not the interpretation of the banality of evil alone that unleashed the tempest of furious responses to Arendt's book, but the combination of this element with her interpretation of the Jewish role in the history of the so-called final solution. One aspect of Arendt's Eichmann book that earned her widespread condemnation and contempt was the way she raised the difficult historical and moral issue of collaboration, complicity by Jewish leaders in the destruction of their own communities. Wherever Jews lived, she argued, quote, there were recognized Jewish leaders, and this leadership, almost without exception, cooperated in one way or another, for one reason or another, with the Nazis. The whole truth was that if the Jewish people had really been unorganized and leaderless, there would have been chaos and plenty of misery, but the total number of victims would hardly have been between 4.5 and 6 million people. And the overall conclusion she gives is hardly more forgiving. Quote, as a Jew, this role of the Jewish leaders in the destruction of their own people is undoubtedly the darkest chapter of the whole dark story, end of quote. Interestingly, this issue had not even been raised at the trial since it had no relevance for the guilt or innocence of the accused. Why then did Hannah Arendt find it necessary to raise the matter? Apparently, she decided it was her solemn duty to narrate what she felt indeed was the darkest chapter from a Jewish point of view, since she believed the prosecution had sought for whatever reasons to blur and conceal these most troubling and disquieting facts. Arendt was not just troubled by the fact that from her point of view, Jews had gone to the death like sheep to the slaughter. In fact, she was extremely critical of Chief Prosecutor Hausner, who kept asking Jewish witnesses about their lack of resistance, and she rejected these questions as silly and cruel. But more importantly, these questions, she claimed, were nothing else but a smokescreen designed to conceal the real question that should have been asked. Quote, "Why did you collaborate in the destruction of your own people and eventually in your own ruin?" Arendt's sweeping and rather merciless condemnation of the Jewish leadership during the Holocaust completely relied on Raoul Hilberg's book, The Destruction of the European Jews. In his study, Hilberg relied almost exclusively on non-Jewish sources, which often portrayed Jews as pliable and servile, easily compromised by appeals to self-interest. Furthermore, according to Hilberg, the collaboration of the Jewish councils with the Nazis was a fairly simple affair. It was the culmination of a deeply rooted Jewish predisposition to acquiesce in the face of persecution. Arendt's provocative conclusion from this image, the accusation that the Jewish councils had betrayed the Jewish people and become part of the Nazis' death machinery, displayed a tendency to blur the existential differences between victims and perpetrators. Acting within the system, Arendt claimed, sacrificing human beings for the sake of the survival of privileged others, the Jewish leaders, too, were caught in the totalitarian system and suffered from a profoundly impaired moral faculty. Whilst Arendt had some sense of empathy for the people sent to the slaughter, she had none for the leaders of the Jewish councils. She did not say that there was any possibility of resistance for them, but she expected them to pursue a policy of what she calls non-participation. Quote, "And in order to do nothing, one did not have to be a saint. One needed only to say, I am just a simple Jew, and I have no desire to play any other role. These people still had a certain limited degree of freedom and of action, just as the SS members, as we know now know, had a limited choice of alternatives." Subsequent historiography, of course, has strongly differentiated this very simplistic image and shown, based on a wider array of historical sources, including the voices of Jewish testimonies, that Arendt, lacking detailed historical knowledge and in her rush to condemn Jewish collaboration, seriously underestimated the complexity and variety of Jewish responses to Nazi Germany. Particularly, Isaiah Trunk's groundbreaking study of the Jewish councils, published in 1972, demonstrated conclusively how Jewish collaboration, far from being voluntary, was predominantly a product of German coercion. What seems obvious is that in almost all cases, the Nazis forced the Jews to establish the councils in a cruel and perverse attempt to involve their victims in their own destruction and compelled their cooperation, often through the most brutal reprisals. Now let me conclude by asking what exactly led to Hannah Arendt's public condemnation in the 1960s, why she was accused of lacking love of the Jewish people, and what her response to this accusation might reveal about her Jewish self-understanding. Ultimately, the substance of the bitter controversy seems to consist in two main elements of her trial report. First of all, Arendt had not found a language through which to narrate past sorrow, suffering, and loss. On the contrary, she had dismissed the dominating Jewish narrative as irrelevant and instead engaged in a polemical, sarcastic, polarizing discussion of the nature of the Holocaust. As a historian and political analyst, she was probably right in giving scientific objectivity and conceptualization priority over the victim's memory. However, she failed to comprehend why almost the entire Jewish public refused to interpret the Jewish tragedy in these abstract terms, and that the historical discourse she inaugurated in her book necessarily had to clash with a contemporary discourse that was dominated by memory and mourning. Secondly, she had fundamentally questioned the image of the Jew as victim, shattering the simple dichotomy of victim and victimizer, guilty and innocent. According to the image that dominated the memories of the survivors, Nazis were sworn anti-Semites who performed unforgivable cruelties, whilst the Jews were a powerless people who faced a demonic enemy driven to fulfill the worst crime in the history of humanity. By pointing to the moral ambiguity of the Jewish leadership and by postulating a common ground of guilt between perpetrators and victims, she had disrupted this clear differentiation between good and evil, horror and banality, perpetrators and victims, and the powerful and the powerless. And even worse, she had done this in the context of the trial of a man responsible for the deportation and murder of millions of Jews. Her line of argument, Dundiner, German historian, summarizes her reader's impressions, seems to have more in common with the self-exonerating perspective of the perpetrators than with the anguish of the victims. Her friend Gershom Scholem, the former scholar of Jewish mysticism, therefore famously accused her in a public letter of being heartless to her own people, of lacking sympathy and solidarity with the victims. As he put it, in the Jewish tradition, there is a concept hard to define and yet concrete enough, which we know as Ahavat Yisrael, love of the Jewish people. In you, dear Hannah, I find little trace of it. And he told her that, quote, the matter of the destruction of one third of our people should require a more sensitive treatment from somebody he still considered to be a daughter of our people. In her response to Scholem, he asserted, first of all, her Jewishness, emphasizing she had never felt any temptation to renounce it. That I am a Jew is one of the unquestioned facts of my life, she says, and I never wanted to alter such brute facts. More importantly, she responded to the reproach of a lack of Ahavat Israel, saying that she in fact did not possess this love, since she was unable to love people, but only humans, and because for her such an obligation towards one ethnic group appeared to be, quote, a rather suspect form of particularism. Quote, the magnificence of this people once lay in its belief in God, that is, in the way its trust and love of God far outweighed its fear of God. And now this people believes only in itself? In this sense, I don't love the Jews, nor do I believe in them. I belong to this people in nature and in fact. End of quote. She presented herself as a Jew who could and would take an independent political stand, whether or not it conformed to anyone else's idea of what a Jew should hold or be. And she added that her Jewishness implied first and foremost the duty and the freedom to criticize her people and demand that they live up to standards higher than those of others. What she appears to have heard in Scholem's letter is a political-theological understanding of Jewish solidarity. And of course, she intuitively rejected it. It seems to me, however, that she missed the point in some ways. Scholem was far from advancing an unthinking Jewish nationalism, and he was not summoning her to love all Jews or give up her independent judgment. Rather, he was simply profoundly shocked that her narrative betrayed no trace of compassion with the Jewish people that had recently been subjected to one of the most brutal episodes of genocide in recorded history. And others have expressed it in much harsher tones. Walter Lacour, historian, said Hannah Arendt's reproaches were those of an outsider lacking identification. They were almost inhumanly cold. Whether or not Hannah Arendt possessed love of the Jewish people is something I simply wouldn't dare to judge. Her Jewish self-understanding appears to be equally difficult to assess. It was certainly more complex and more ambiguous than what Bernard Wasserstein's essay quoted earlier reveals. This ambivalence can certainly be criticized. Richard Wolin, for example, claims that although vigorously confessing her sense of belonging to the Jewish people or to the Jewish community of faith, quote, she adhered to a problematic separation between Jewishness and Judaism as religion, an idea that she admits frankly never held much of an attraction for her. What is it that remains of Jewishness when one has jettisoned Judaism was a matter she never addressed. And Richard Bernstein, in his interpretation of Arendt's depiction of Judaism and Jewish history in her work, characterizes her self-understanding as being a conscious pariah among a pariah people, adding that her distinction between Jewishness and Judaism is extremely problematic. By taking the existence of the Jewish people as a historical fact and then just concerning herself with social and political questions whilst avoiding the religious dimension amounts in his eyes to an attitude of avoiding the question of Jewish identity instead of answering it. But to my mind, things are still more complicated. Like so many German Jewish emigre intellectuals, she was a secular Jew, profoundly alienated from Jewish faith and equally profoundly shaped by her refugee experience, which gave her a sense of belonging to the Jewish people on the one hand and an awareness of the universal dimension of her Jewish experience on the other. Her critique of nationalism, including Zionism, emerged from the historical experience of the Jewish people in the 1930s and 1940s, an experience that entailed the political obligation to analyze and oppose discrimination, persecution, human rights violations, deportations, and genocide on a universal level. Jewishness in a secular post-Holocaust world, from her point of view, included a universal ethical and political obligation that went beyond ethnic and national boundaries. And finally, as I've tried to show elsewhere in an analysis of her friendship to the philosopher Hans Jonas, her Jewishness even included a certain fascination with a sense of transcendence and mystery in Judaism, something that led Jonas to speculate about a religious element of her Jewish identity. Her self-understanding as a Jew, as a universal political theorist, philosopher, and historian belonging to the Jewish people, is thus, as I have tried to indicate in my lecture, not easy to grasp. An ambivalence, however, that reflects the complexities of modern Jewish identity in general, particularly after the Holocaust. Thank you very much.